Today on ID the Future, we're happy to bring you another interview with Dr. Tom Woodward, host of the Universe Next Door syndicated radio broadcast. In conjunction with Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture, Dr. Woodward regularly interviews CSC scientists and scholars on various aspects of the debate over Darwinian evolution and intelligent design.
ID the Future's gift to you. What a pleasure to settle into a holiday with a good book to read. Better than one book, of course, is two. Or how about 12 new books or DVDs? Starting on Black Friday, we'll have 12 days of discounts on Intelligent Design and Evolution resources, with a new item specially discounted each day. Be sure to check evolutionnews.org for each day's item. That's 12 days of discounts at evolutionnews.org. Now back to ID the Future.
Welcome to the Universe Next Door. We have been having a lot of excitement here in Florida with blustery weather alternating with beautiful Tampa Bay weather, but I know that that's not the case everywhere in the country.
Oh, our poor friends in the Northeast. Now, San Francisco is just kind of cool all the time.
Yeah, they are a cool metro area to hang out in. We know the people listening in Ohio and all kinds of interesting places in the Northeast may have to be still digging out from snow here and there in coming weeks, but we are enjoying the basking of wonderful, you might say, subtropical temperatures here.
Let's not rub it in.
Okay. But we do really are thankful that we have this opportunity to broadcast on the Universe Next Door program information that goes beyond just the local weather, because we're talking about very important issues of the universe that is physical and the universe that is mental, or you might say worldview oriented. And so that's our approach every week, is to analyze the reasons, the good, solid, you might say verifiable reasons for embracing one particular worldview. And the worldview, of course, that C.S. Lewis embraced, the one that we advocate and seek to explain and vindicate here, is the one of Judeo-Christianity. Put it in simplest terms, the biblical worldview, that there is a God who made us and we are made for a purpose, and it's an exciting, wonderful purpose. And part of the adventure of life is to discover and to live that out in all of its fullness, including intellectual or you might say wise fullness, the wisdom of the ages. Well, part of the wisdom of the ages is learning about life, and we have an expert with us. He has agreed to rejoin us this week for another discussion. We were really just kind of, you might say, getting into high gear about 1 week ago with Dr. Paul Nelson. He is an affiliate, a fellow of the Discovery Institute. He is a graduate PhD with an emphasis on the history, and especially, I guess, Dr. Paul Nelson would be the philosophy of biology.
That's right. It's funny, evolutionary theory has such a significant philosophical and even theological component that it's good to have one foot in that as well as another foot in the science itself.
Yeah. Well, you have feet in many sides of this evolutionary discussion. And even though I know you only have 2 feet, but you managed to keep them moving very quickly in such things as the Leventhal paradox, something that I did not know about until you clued me in on this amazing line of discussion of even the cellular substrate, you might say the protein threads that make up our very being. And we're going to be talking about the Leventhal paradox. It's fascinating. I know that I was excited to hear about it. We also will be discussing just a little bit of more about the origin of life, and even, if we have time, orphan genes. And we have been really blessed to hear about orphan genes in the past, and I just want to get an update to see if the Darwinian headache has been lessening as they pop their own version of Tylenol, aspirin, or ibuprofen, or is the headache getting worse? I do need to get an update on that. So I have a friend, Dr. Paul Nelson, who is a graduate of Princeton University, same class of 72. His name is Cy Newman, and I just saw him recently, you know, within the last several months at a football game. Princeton played Georgetown. We met there and had a great little mini reunion. And he handed me a folded, an origami, I believe it was a dollar bill. Yes, it was a dollar bill, folded in the form of an elephant. Now, that doesn't necessarily betray his, let's say, political leanings. I think he might have more likely handed me a donkey. But in this case, it's actually sitting on my dresser on a little platform that comes out from the side of the mirror on my dresser. And that beautiful brilliantly, including that not only the tusks and the trunk, but all 4 feet and even the tail and the head absolutely looks, it's a tiny thing, about two inches, let's say, in length. So that is a folded piece, single piece of paper, an origami creation. We're all familiar with the art of origami, but you're saying that there's something interesting going on in our cells, the protein version or parallel to origami, and there's a mystery attached, a Leventhal paradox, if you will. Would you lead us into that strange territory?
Yeah. Cyrus Leventhal was a leading protein chemist, and in the 60s, he noticed something very puzzling about proteins. Proteins are long strings of individual amino acids. Typically, they're 100 amino acids or longer. Most are in the 150 to 300 range. These are individual units, and they can rotate on their bond. So one amino acid is joined to the next, very much like kids' blocks. Remember in the blocks your child might have had where you pop one into the other, and you can rotate them at that point where they're joining. And Leventhal looked at that, and he said, if I just take the string itself, let's say 150 amino acids, they're all different. You know, there are a set of actually 22 now that we know that are used in building proteins. And I look at them and I ask, how many different ways can they be arranged? It's an astronomically large number. When you begin to calculate the degrees of freedom, that is the possible ways they could rotate in each case, you get this really big space of possibilities. But the amazing thing about proteins is they know where they're going. Once, under normal circumstances within the cell, the protein begins to fold, it heads to one tiny point within that huge space, namely the three-dimensional form it will take, that string will take, it'll fold up into the three-dimensional form that it uses to do its job within the cell. So Leventhal asked the question, how does it know? How does it know where it's going? I mean, if you think of a blank sheet of paper, like regular typing paper and origami, that blank sheet can go in the direction of a swan or a little car or a house or, in your case, an elephant. The folds themselves are not determined by the blank sheet of paper. It can go in any number of directions depending on the particular series of folds that you provide. So Leventhal scratched his head and he said, somehow proteins are like self-folding origami. They know where they're going. Mm-hmm. And those shapes are not the same. They're as different as an elephant is from a swan. All right, now, here's the puzzle for the origin of life. We're not talking about a single protein. We're talking about hundreds of proteins. Current estimates say that to have any kind of functional cell at all, you would need probably in the range of 250 to 300 proteins, probably more, but that's a minimal set that you would need. And those are all going to be different. They're going to have different shapes because they'll be doing different jobs. So we're not talking about a single protein. We're talking about hundreds of proteins, but not just proteins. You need lipids. Those are the structures that make up the cell wall. You need DNA and RNA. Those are the information carriers. You need a range of different molecules present all within the same microscopic space to give you life.
And you might even need certain parts of the epigenetic tags.
Exactly. You would need higher level, what you just alluded to, Tom, is a kind of multiple levels of higher information that are not represented by the molecules themselves, but actually by their addresses, if you will, their zip codes, their interrelations. Another pair of protein chemists recently, one of them is named George Rose, and the other is Peter Tompa, who he's Belgian. They wrote a paper and they said, we can find the same kind of Leventhal paradox, but at the level of a whole cell. And they said, there's something very significant here. If you take a cell and disrupt its membrane or disrupt the cell wall, you've got all the parts that you need. They're all present. But those parts now are going to head irreversibly towards basic chemistry. They're not going to re-self-organize. And Tompa and Rose said, there's a reason for that. There's really only one or two, at most a handful of ways of arranging all those parts to give you the living state. There is an indefinitely greater number of states that won't give you the living state. So if you think in terms of a three-dimensional space, you've got this huge box of being dead, right? Mm-hmm. Most of the box is colored or marked with, it's over, you're dead. There's one tiny bright point, maybe in the center of that box where you're alive. So they say in this paper, once you leave that bright point and head out away from it, You're going to be out in the random dead space, and you're never, ever going to get back. And they say this is the reason that Origin of Life research has been sterile, has basically failed to solve the problem, because they argue, in fact, they put this right in the paper, they say, if you want a cell, you need to start with a cell. Cellular reproduction, cellular existence presupposes the existence of at least another cell. The parts themselves are not going to give you the living state. In a very mysterious way that we don't really understand, it's only when those parts are in the particular correct arrangement with each other that you're able to metabolize and transport and reproduce and do all the other functions that a living cell can do. So I love that image because I think it's very suggestive. In fact, I think it's accurate. You've got an enormous space of being dead and one tiny bright point where you're alive, and you've got to stay there. Hmm. And once you lose that and begin wandering out in the random dead area, you will never find your way back. That's why no one who opens a can of tuna ever expects to see a tuna jump out.
Well, that's very important insight into the amazing substrate, you might say, that the bottom level, but also the arrangement of all those parts together. Today with us, Dr. Paul Nelson. He is an expert in a number of fields pertaining to evolutionary biology, intelligent design, and specifically these very nitty-gritty levels of what's going on in the world of biological world of a single cell. Dr. Paul Nelson is featured right now in a special slide at the top of our apologetics.org webpage, and we are going to allow you to the opportunity to zip on over there and follow the links to the articles that he has written and that have been posted at evolutionnews.org. We'll be entering the world of the biological puzzle of the cell itself and looking at orphan genes and seeing what's new on that waterfront. We'll be right back with Dr. Paul Nelson on The Universe Next Door. I'm Tom Woodward, your host. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Universe Next Door, where today we're enjoying a delightful conversation with Dr. Paul Nelson. He is a fellow of the Discovery Institute, working in the area especially of biology and dealing from the you might say, the high-tech side of experimental research as well as the theoretical side of analyzing the results, thinking outside the box and trying to draw the important conclusions for what we're learning about biology today. It can be a bit of a shock. Dr. Paul Nelson, of course, is a friend of the C.S. Lewis Society. And Dr. Paul Nelson, I don't think you would be against people reading C.S. Lewis.
No, in fact, I would say C.S. Lewis is a wonderful introduction to this topic because even in the middle decades of the last century, he saw clearly the implications of a materialist outlook, that it robbed us of our dignity, that it robbed us of our freedom. And in fact, I would say the third book in his great trilogy, his space trilogy, That Hideous Strength, was prophetic about trends that we now see in 2014 coming to fruition. So C.S. Lewis has meant the world to me, and he wasn't a scientist, but boy, could he think.
He certainly could. And when he was invited to go on BBC Radio back in February of 1941, his first letter written to James Welch is, "Yes, I think I would rather enjoy giving a series of talks on Christianity." And he used the phrase, I think I would like to use the title, The Art of Being Shocked. And they didn't use that title, of course, as it was gathered together. The first little volume was Broadcast Talks. And then in 1952, all the talks together became Mere Christianity. But I sort of like that phrase, The Art of Being Shocked. And I think that we are in the world of biology finding something of, among biologists, they're learning the art of being shocked at what they're finding under their noses. Let's talk about orphan genes. And if I could just give a shameless plug to our own book that Dr. Gills and I were able to write about a quarter each of that book. And then we invited the likes of Philip Johnson, Charles Thaxton, William Dembski, Michael Behe, a couple other wonderful authors, a guy working at Westmont College contributed on the retina. And then there was another article that I worked on with a young geneticist, and my article on the orphan gene problem was really focused on the yeast genome, which was yielding some strange discoveries. First, Paul, describe, you know, in a rather succinct manner, as you're so gifted at doing, what do we mean by an orphan gene?
Well, there's a pun in the title. An ORF is an open reading frame. That's a section of DNA that codes for protein.
That's an ORF?
An ORF. Yeah. So adding AN, an orphan is a gene that doesn't have any apparent parents. Hmm. It's sort of sitting out there all by itself in protein sequence space. Hmm. So let me give you a linguistic analogy. Imagine that I give you a book in English, and you open it up, and every 20th word you've never seen before. So you trot out off, you know, to your dictionary, your Funkin' Wagnalls, or, you know, got it, the Oxford English Dictionary, and you look for the corresponding match, right? You look, well, I don't know, I haven't seen this word before. I'm going to go look it up. It's not there. In an exactly parallel way, orphan genes puzzle biologists because when they go to their genetic dictionaries, like GenBank, which is the computer repository mm-hmm. for every published DNA sequence, and they submit these new DNA words, they don't find any corresponding matches there in GenBank. Now, that's puzzling for a couple of reasons. The most important reason is evolutionary expectations tell us every gene that we see had a parent gene, and you should be able to trace the history of those genes backwards through time to the set present in the original common ancestor of all of life. Mm. Orphans are puzzling because, as the pun in their name implies, they don't have any apparent genetic parents. They're unique sequences.
It's like as if they had no evolutionary history to them.
None that we can detect.
Wow.
So when these were first discovered, when whole genome sequencing began as a practical technology in the mid-90s, people said, well, it's probably an artifact of sampling. Hmm. So let me again go back to natural language, like English. You'd say, well, you just haven't done your dictionary properly. As we search more and more texts, we'll find more and more words, and eventually we'll put in place the ancestors to these orphans. What's happened, though, since 1995 is, by and large, the ancestors or the parental sequences, or the put it more accurately, the related sequences for orphans have not been found. And the signal from one genome to the next, and DNA sequencing now is very inexpensive and very rapid, so it's a huge ocean of data to sift through. Mm-hmm. The signal that would have shown that orphans, in fact, belong in, you know, known families of genes, that hasn't been found. And what we find are consistent high percentages for each species that we examine.
What do you mean by high percentages?
Well, let's say for a virus, most viruses, I would say probably half or more of their genes have no matches.
That's shocking.
It is shocking because viruses by far represent the greatest amount of genetic information on this planet. In a liter of seawater, just normal seawater, there are trillions of viruses. And it was a shock, and that's not too strong a word, it was a shock to the biological community to realize that viruses have this enormous reservoir of unique genetic information that's not found anywhere else. But even in bacteria, typically 10%, 10 to 15% of the genome of any bacterial group that's sequenced is unique. And even within well-known groups like E. coli, now those are the bacteria in our large intestine, if you sequence strains of E. coli, so you're within that species, and you're just looking at different strains within that species, you will see genes you've never observed before. And several different research groups have looked at this, and they said, if we plot a curve of sampling, it tells us that the bacterial pangenome, that's all the genes and all the bacteria on this planet, they estimate that is infinitely large. Now, that's hyperbole. There are not an infinite number of cells on this planet. What really we should say is the outer horizon of the genetic diversity just of bacteria cannot be seen. Because every time we sequence a new bacterial species, we see genes that we've never seen before.
But isn't this a phenomenon that can be juxtaposed against the apparent difficulty of hitting on that unique pattern if it's evolution just meandering and experimenting?
Yes. And in fact, this is where I think the research is going to go, because evolution has a speed limit. You cannot jump in sequence space from a sequence of DNA that gives you a functional protein. You can't leap to another point in sequence space and expect to hit anything. A random string of nucleotides is likely to give you a random string of amino acids, which won't give you a protein at all. Mm. And I think what's happening is the speed limit on evolution is not anywhere close to what's needed to explain the genetic diversity of life on this planet. Now, why does intelligent design illuminate this? Well, a designer is not bound by a speed limit. A designer can go to any point in sequence space and say, you know what, I need a nice little protein over here. Doesn't matter to me if it's related to other proteins. I need a specialized protein to perform this function at this point in sequence space. The designer can go there and not worry about connecting that to the rest of life. So this is a place where intelligent design as a research paradigm, makes very clear predictions that differ strongly from those that you would get from naturalistic common descent.
Very good. Today with us, Dr. Paul Nelson, expert on the genome, on orphan genes, on a myriad, perhaps even dozens and dozens of topics. But the one we're focused on, orphan genes, leads me to ask this question, Dr. Nelson. If you were a Darwinian theorist and you had to make a prediction of, or at least an expectation of what you hope this signal would wind up arriving at the number of orphan genes, let's say as a percentage of the genome of a eukaryote, of a higher animal, what would your hoped for arrival? Would it be 1%, 2%, or 3%, 5% at the most? And then compare with that what it actually is turning out to be, the typical orphan gene percentage of the total of an animal.
Well, let me give you a concrete example that really struck me. When I first presented orphans in a research meeting about 7 or 8 years ago, there was a very famous geneticist there. I won't name him because it was a private meeting, but if I said his name, everyone in your audience would instantly recognize it. And I gave a little talk on this, and he just waved his hands. He was sitting right next to me, 3 feet away. He waved his hands, and he said, "Paul, nobody cares." He said, "We find orphans mostly in viruses and prokaryotes, single-celled organisms without a nucleus. We don't find them," he said, "in animals. And until you find them in complex critters, nobody's going to care." Well, I had to swallow my pride because at the time, most of the whole genomes that were available were, in fact, from from prokaryotes. All right, fast forward to the present. We now have a much greater number of genomes available, including 6 genomes from ants. 6 different ant species had all their DNA sequenced between 2010 and 2011. And the orphan percentages in those genomes is around 10% per genome. Okay, now, there are about 14,000 ant species on this planet. If every species has 10% unique genetic words, right? Mm-hmm. Genes that are not present in any other ant species. If you work those numbers backwards down the evolutionary tree, you get to a common ancestor of the ants, which is what evolution predicts, that all ants are descended from a common ancestor. With an enormous genome, huge, way beyond anything that's biologically plausible. I mean, the numbers just blow your mind. Where did all that unique genetic information come from? And what's so striking about these orphans in the different groups where they've been examined is they're not just little peripheral players off to one side, not really doing anything important. In case after case, the orphans that have been found are essential to the biology of their respective species. So social behavior, for instance, in bees appears to be moderated or regulated by orphans. Some salamanders can regenerate their limbs, which is a great function to be able to do, right?
Yeah.
That appears to be orphan moderated.
Well, what I can say is that this is such a lively topic that we're going to follow it out on your articles that are posted on the Paul Nelson special frame. It's a moving slider at the top of our website, apologetics.org. Very exciting news relevant to the discussion of creation, evolution, and intelligent design. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Paul Nelson.
Thank you, Tom.
And thank you for listening to The Universe Next Door. Join us online at apologetics.org.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2014. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.